This is the Cursus Publicus for Friday, July 3rd, 2026. Intelligence from the Global Frontier. I'm Valeria.
And I'm Marcus. Good to have you with us. It's a heavy board today. A widening disaster in Venezuela. A high-tech smuggling case in Singapore. A justice sector reset in Central America. And the slow, deliberate pressure China keeps applying around Taiwan.
Let's set the table with the bottom line up front. Venezuela's earthquake death toll has climbed to 2,595, with roughly 50,000 people still unaccounted for, and the interim government's own experts are now openly criticizing the response. In Singapore, authorities have seized a $42 million mansion and frozen accounts tied to a scheme that allegedly funneled servers packed with NVIDIA artificial intelligence chips toward China in violation of U.S. export controls. And in Guatemala, a new attorney general is moving to unwind a predecessor era that Washington and Europe had sanctioned for stifling anti-corruption work.
And underneath all of that, Valeria, the great power track just keeps humming. China's Coast Guard and military are hardening what analysts now call a permanent gray zone campaign east of Taiwan. And over in Warsaw, Poland has just broken up a Belarusian espionage cell targeting exiles. So let's get into it. Where do you want to start?
Let's start in Central America, in Guatemala. The country's new attorney general, Gabriel Garcia Luna, who took office in May, has pledged to dismantle what he called the repressive and vengeful legacy of his predecessor. That predecessor, Consuelo Porras, was sanctioned by the United States and other governments for stifling anti-corruption cases and driving justice officials into exile. Garcia Luna made the pledge on July 1st, and his office is now coordinating with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, the regional body that investigates rights abuses across the Americas, which has scheduled an August 4th hearing on political persecution claims from the Porras era. Marcus, why does this one matter to us?
Because Guatemala's justice sector has long been a sore spot for U.S. law enforcement cooperation on transnational crime. A genuine anti-corruption reset should, on balance, improve the reliability of the counterpart institutions our liaison networks lean on for vetting and information sharing. The thing I'd watch for, the signal that would undercut all of it, is a backlash from porous loyalists that stalls the transition.
Good to know. Now let's move to South America and the Caribbean, and to the day's most serious human story. In Venezuela, Acting President Delcy Rodriguez says the death toll from the June 24th earthquake doublet, two large quakes striking in close succession, has reached 2,595, with roughly 50,000 people still unaccounted for. There was one remarkable bright spot, a survivor pulled alive from the rubble after 8 days. But experts quoted by PBS and others describe the government's recovery effort as completely ineffective, and the United States has surged disaster relief, despite its broader cuts to foreign aid.
And this is where the story reaches us, Valeria. It's all downstream. A prolonged, badly managed recovery in an already fragile state compounds Venezuela's existing outmigration pressure. Continued deterioration is likely to sustain, or even increase, secondary movement toward the United States through the transit corridor. And that sharpens the workload for the traveler screening and advanced targeting functions that operate well upstream of the border. I'll flag it plainly, this picture is still developing, and the numbers may shift.
Staying in the region, the United States has designated Ecuador's Chone Killers gang as a foreign terrorist organization. The Chone Killers are a splinter faction of the already designated Los Choneros, and they've carried out assassinations of Ecuadorian officials and law enforcement officers. On July 1st, the State Department named them both a foreign terrorist organization and a specially designated global terrorist, part of a broader campaign against Latin American organized crime, and a move welcomed by Ecuadorian President Daniel Noboa's government.
The practical effect is twofold. The designation criminalizes any material support to the group under U.S. law, and it will sharpen cargo and traveler vetting tied to Ecuadorian nodes in the wider Andean smuggling network. What I'm watching is the continued fragmentation of Ecuador's gang landscape, because every time one group gets degraded, new corridors and alliances tend to spring up to replace it.
Let's stay in the region for one more, a political flashpoint in Colombia. The vice president-elect, José Manuel Restrepo, has rejected a rival's call for what that rival termed peaceful civil disobedience against the incoming government. The defeated candidate, Ivan Cepeda, has questioned the eligibility of President-elect Abelardo de la Espriella, who takes office August 7th, over dual nationality and past contacts with the United States, and says any mobilization would be coordinated with social movements. Restrepo called that an undemocratic tantrum. Marcus, how worried should we be?
Not very, is my read. I expect the August 7th handover to proceed without materially disrupting liaison continuity or joint counter-narcotics cooperation, despite all the heated rhetoric. The variable that actually decides it is the incoming administration's early posture on U.S. cooperation, so watch its first moves, not the campaign noise.
All right, let's cross the Atlantic to Europe, and a hostile state intelligence case. Poland's Internal Security Agency, known by its initials ABW, has detained two people accused of spying on Belarusian exiles for Minsk. The pair, a 19-year-old Belarusian national and a 44-year-old Polish citizen, were detained on July 2nd, accused of photographing and filming participants at Belarusian community events in Warsaw and passing that material to Belarusian intelligence and state propaganda outlets. The case extends an investigation that already led to the detention of three Belarusians and two Ukrainians last November.
Here's why it lands on our desk. Continued Belarusian intelligence targeting of exile communities on Allied soil is a reminder that hostile state surveillance and coercion move through the very same European travel and residency channels our liaison partners rely on. It argues for continued vigilance on watchlisting and information sharing with the host government.
Still in Europe, a significant weapons seizure in northern Greece. The region's organized crime unit intercepted a shipment of 50 semi-automatic pistols with no serial numbers, so-called ghost guns, untraceable by design, along with 49 magazines, all vacuum-sealed in luggage. The Wednesday evening sting targeted freight corridors running through the Evros border region, the frontier with Turkey. Two Turkish nationals were arrested, and authorities say the weapons were bound for Turkish organized crime networks operating inside Greece.
And here's the detail that turns this from a headline into a pattern. Valeria. This is the third such ghost gun interception in that area since October 2025. Third time. That's not a one-off. That's a channel.
Before we leave Europe, one more, and it's a great follow-the-money story out of Ireland. The country's Criminal Assets Bureau, working with Europol's European Cybercrime Center, confirmed on July 2nd that it has recovered a third batch of 500 Bitcoin tied to a convicted cannabis trafficker named Clifton Collins. Depending on how you value it, that batch is worth somewhere between $30 and $90 million. Collins' original stash ran to 6,000 Bitcoin, split across roughly a dozen wallets, and was long thought unrecoverable. With this recovery, the total reclaimed reaches 1,500 Bitcoin, but 9 of the 12 original wallets, worth well over $275 million at current prices, are still untouched.
And I love this one, because it's a reminder that a decade-old drug case can still be paying out. The money leaves a trail, and the trail keeps its shape a long time.
Let's turn to Africa and the Middle East, where Sudan's war keeps pushing people across borders. The United Nations Migration Agency, the International Organization for Migration, says roughly 6,000 people fled the town of Colbas and three nearby villages in Sudan's West Darfur after members of the Rapid Support Forces, the paramilitary group fighting the National Army, threatened residents over their perceived support for that army. Most of those who fled crossed the border into Chad. The Sudanese army has since claimed it retook Colbas, a rare gain in Western Darfur since the fall of El-Fasher.
The broader significance is a slow burn. Sudan's civil war keeps generating large, sudden cross-border displacement. And while the primary flows stay regional, sustained conflict and state collapse feed the wider pool of protracted displacement populations that eventually surface in irregular migration flows much further along the international routes border authorities screen against. This account, too, is still developing.
Staying with migration, the European Union is narrowing its search for so-called return hubs. Member states led by Denmark, Austria, Germany, the Netherlands, and Greece are now focusing on Rwanda and Uzbekistan to host the EU's first offshore centers for rejected asylum seekers under the newly approved returns regulation. Libya and Egypt have been dropped from consideration. Greece's prime minister says the goal is to conclude initial agreements this year for a 2027 start, though rights groups warn that both candidate states lack adequate human rights guarantees. Marcus, does this one actually happen?
Eventually, maybe quickly. I doubt it. A functioning third country return framework would shrink the pool of rejected claimants in Europe and reshape the onward secondary migration patterns that surface in transatlantic screening data. But I'd expect the rollout to slip rather than deliver in the near term. That's the track record of prior EU and UK third country schemes. A signed, operational agreement is the signal that this time is different.
And finally, to Asia and the Pacific, with two national security stories to close the body of the brief. First, Singapore and that major seizure. On July 1st, Singapore police issued a prohibition of disposal order against a $42 million bungalow and froze roughly $772,000 in bank funds belonging to executives of a firm called the Aperia Group. Those executives face new fraud and money laundering charges. Prosecutors allege that between 2023 and 2025, they misrepresented the end users of servers made by Dell, Supermicro, and Asus, servers containing NVIDIA chips, to bypass U.S. export controls, with the hardware allegedly destined for China. Four firms now face corporate fraud charges. A first for this probe.
And the takeaway is plain. Southeast Asian transshipment hubs remain a favored channel for evading controls on sensitive American technology. If you want to move restricted chips, you route them through a trusted-looking address first. This is that, in a courtroom.
And that brings us to the last story. Taiwan. Analysts now assess that China's gray zone pressure east of the island is becoming a permanent posture. China Coast Guard vessels have patrolled almost continuously east of Taiwan since June 1st, under a new model Beijing calls nearshore governance. Meanwhile, aircraft sorties by China's People's Liberation Army near Taiwan are up sharply year on year, about 3,760, up from roughly 3,060, with a comparable rise in naval activity, according to think tank tracking cited this week. Marcus, bring us home on this one.
Happy to. The key judgment is that Beijing is normalizing a civilian and paramilitary gray zone fleet presence, not solely preparing for an invasion. It's a posture designed to erode Taiwanese control below the threshold of armed conflict. And here's why it matters to us. A hardening, open-ended campaign like this raises the odds of a disruptive incident affecting regional shipping and air routes with very little warning. It also underscores the broader strategic competition backdrop against which our port security and cargo targeting cooperation with regional partners now operates. So before we go, Valeria, let me put down some markers. Here's what we're watching in the days ahead. In North America, a third round of U.S.-Mexico talks on the joint review of the USMCA Trade Pact, the successor to the old North American Free Trade Agreement, convenes the week of July 20th. My expectation, the round ends with the agreement still in force, and its long-term status unresolved. No breakthrough, no collapse. In Guatemala, I expect the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights to hold its August 4th hearing on Porras-era political persecution claims as scheduled, not postpone it. In Colombia, I expect De La Espriella to be inaugurated on August 7th as planned, with Cepeda's threatened civil disobedience failing to materially disrupt the transfer of power. And on European migration, I expect the EU will not conclude a finalized return hub agreement with either Rwanda or Uzbekistan before the end of September. The talks are more likely to slip, as these schemes tend to.
Marcus, thank you. And that is today's brief. For the full edition, every source behind these stories, and the searchable archive, go to archive.cursuspublic.us.
The Cursus Publicus is personal, unofficial, and open source.
Statum et ubique. Swiftly and everywhere. We'll see you tomorrow.